Arnie had said, the Southern mob or the Colombians. It sounded melodramatic, but possible. No, more, it sounded plausible. But the mob shot people, pushed them out of windows, strangled them. According to legend, Al Capone had disposed of one poor sucker with a lead-cored baseball bat. But to drive a car over some guy's snow-covered lawn and slam it through the side of his house and into his living room? The Colombians, maybe. Arnie said the Colombians are crazy. But that crazy? I didn't think so. She glittered in the light from the house and the stars. And what if it was her? And what if she found out that Lee and I had our suspicions? Worse yet, what if she found out that we'd been fooling around?
You need help on the steps, Dennis?
Arnie asked, startling me. No, I can handle the steps, I said. You might have to give me a hand on the path.
No problem, man.
I got down the kitchen steps side saddle, clutching the railing in one hand and my crutches in the other. On the path, I set them under me, got a couple of steps, and then slipped. A dull thud of pain rumbled up my left leg, the one that still wasn't worth doodly squat. Arnie grabbed me.
Thanks,
I said, glad of a chance to sound shaky.
No sweat.
We got over to the car. Arnie asked if I could get in by myself. I said I could. He left me and crossed around the front of Christine's hood. I got hold of the door handle with one gloved hand, and a hopeless feeling of dread and revulsion swept over me. It wasn't until then that I really began to believe it, deep inside where a person lives, because that door handle felt alive under my hand. It felt like some living beast that was asleep. The door handle didn't feel like chrome steel. Dear Christ, it felt like skin. It seemed as if I could squeeze it and wake the beast up, roaring. Beast? Okay, what beast? What was it? Some sort of afreet? An ordinary car that had somehow become the dangerous, stinking dwelling place of a demon? A weird manifestation of LeBay's lingering personality? A hellish, haunted house that rolled on Goodyear rubber? I didn't know. All I knew was that I was scared, terrified. I didn't think I could go through with this.
Hey, you okay?
Arnie asked.
Can you make it?
I can make it,
I said hoarsely, and jammed my thumb down on the button below the handle. I opened the door, turned my back on the seat, and let myself fall backward onto it, left leg extending stiffly. I got hold of my leg and swung it in. It was like moving a piece of furniture. My heart was trip-hammering in my chest. I pulled the door shut. Arnie turned the key and the motor rumbled to life, as if the engine were hot instead of dead cold. And the smell assaulted me, seeming to come from everywhere, but most of all, seeming to pour up from the upholstery, the sick, rich, rotten smell of death and decay. I don't know how to tell you about that ride home, that 3-mile ride that lasted no more than 10 or 12 minutes, without sounding like an escapee from a lunatic asylum. There is no way to be objective about it. Just sitting here and trying is enough to make me feel cold and hot at the same time, feverish and ill. There is no way to separate what was real and what my mind might have manufactured. No dividing line between objective and subjective, between the truth and horrified hallucination. But it wasn't drunkenness. If I can assure you of nothing else, I can assure you of that. Any mild high I retained from the beer evaporated immediately. What followed was a cold, sober tour of the country of the damned. We went back in time, for one thing. For a while, Arnie wasn't driving at all. It was LeBay, rotting and stinking of the grave, half-skeleton and half-rotting spongy flesh, greenly corroded buttons. Maggots squirmed their sluggish way up from his collar. I could hear a low buzzing sound and thought at first it was a short circuit in one of the dashboard lights. It was only later that I began to think it might have been the sound of flies hatching in his flesh. Of course, it was wintertime, but at times, there seemed to be other people in the car with us. Once I glanced up into the rearview mirror and saw a wax dummy of a woman staring at me with the bright and sparkling eyes of a stuffed trophy. Her hair was done in a 50s pageboy style. Her cheeks appeared to have been wildly rouged, and I remembered that carbon monoxide poisoning was supposed to give the illusion of life and high color. Later, I glanced into the mirror again and seemed to see a little girl back there, her face blackened with strangulation, her eyes popping like those of some cruelly squeezed stuffed animal. I shut my eyes tight, and when I opened them, It was Buddy Repperton and Richie Trelawney in the rearview mirror. Crusted blood had dried on Buddy's mouth, chin, neck, and shirt. Richie was a roasted hulk, but his eyes were alive and aware. Slowly, Buddy extended his arm. He was holding a bottle of Texas Driver in one blackened hand. I closed my eyes once more, and after that, I didn't look into the rearview mirror anymore. I remember rock and roll on the radio. Dion and the Belmonts, Ernie K. Doe, the Royal Teens, Bobby Rydell. I remember that for a while, red styrofoam dice seemed to be hanging from the rearview mirror. Then for a while, there were baby shoes, and then there was neither one. Most of all, I remember seizing the idea that these things, like the smell of rotting flesh and moldy upholstery, were only in my mind, that they were no more than the mirages that haunt the consciousness of an opium eater. I was like someone who is badly stoned and trying to make some kind of rational conversation with a straight person, because Arnie and I did talk, I remember that, but not what we talked about. I held up my end, I kept my voice normal, I responded, and that 10 or 12 minutes seemed to last hours. I have told you that it is impossible to be objective about that ride. If there was a logical progression of events, it is lost to me now, blocked out. That journey through the cold black night really was like a trip on a boulevard through hell. I can't remember everything that happened, but I can remember more than I want to. We backed out of the driveway and into a mad funhouse world where all the creeps were real. We went back in time, I have said, but did we? The present-day streets of Libertyville were still there, but they were like a thin overlay of film. It was as if Libertyville of the late 1970s had been drawn on saran wrap and laid over a time that was somehow more real, and I could feel that time reaching its dead hands out toward us, trying to catch us and draw us in forever. Arnie stopped at intersections where we should have had the right of way. At others, where traffic lights glowed red, he cruised Christine mildly through without even slowing. On Main Street, I saw Shipstad's jewelry store and the Strand Theater, both of them torn down in 1972 to make way for the new Pennsylvania Merchants Bank. The cars parked along the street, gathered here and there in clumps where New Year's Eve parties were going on, all seemed to be pre-60s, or pre-1958. Long portholed Buicks, a DeSoto Firelight station wagon with a body-long blue inset that looked like a checkmark, a 57 Dodge Lancer four-door hardtop, Ford Fairlanes with their distinctive taillights, each like a big colon lying on its side, Pontiacs in which the grill had not yet been split, Ramblers, Packards, a few bullet-nosed Studebakers, and once, fantastical and new, an Edsel.
"Yeah, this year's gonna be better," Arnie said.
I glanced over at him. He raised his beer can to his lips, and before it got there, his face had turned to LeBay's, a rotting figure from a horror comic. The fingers that held the beer were only bones. I swear to you, they were only bones. And the pants lay nearly flat against the seat, as if there was nothing inside them except broomsticks.
"Is it?"
I said, breathing the car's foul and choking miasma as shallowly as possible, and trying not to choke.
"It is," LeBay said.
Only now he was Arnie again, and as we paused at a stop sign, I saw a 77 Camaro go ripping past.
"All I ask is that you stand by me a little, Dennis. Don't let my mother drag you into this shit. Things are gonna turn out."
He was LeBay again, grinning fleshlessly and eternally at the idea of things turning out. I felt my brains beginning to totter. Surely I would scream soon. I dropped my eyes from that terrible half-face and saw what Lee had seen. Dashboard instruments that weren't instruments at all, but luminescent green eyes bulging out at me. At some point, the nightmare ended. We pulled up at the curb in an area of town I didn't even recognize, an area I would have sworn I had never seen before. Tract houses stood dark everywhere, some of them three-quarters finished, some no more than frames. Halfway down the block, lit by Christine's high beams, was a sign which read, "Maple Way Estates, Libertyville Realtors Sole Selling Agents, a good place to raise your family. Think about it."
"Well, there you go," Arnie said. "Can you make it up the walk yourself, man?"
I looked doubtfully around this deserted, snow-covered development, and then nodded. Better here, on crutches, alone, than in that terrible car. I felt a large plastic smile on my face.
Sure. Thanks. Negative perspiration, Arnie said.
He finished his beer, and LeBay tossed it into a litter bag.
Another dead soldier.
Yeah, I said. Happy New Year, Arnie. I fumbled for the door handle and opened it. I wondered if I could get out, if my trembling arms would support the crutches. LeBay was looking at me, grinning.
Just stay on my side, Dennis, he said. You know what happens to shitters who don't.
Yes, I whispered.
I knew, all right.
I got my crutches out and heaved myself up onto them, careless of any ice that might be underneath. They held me. And once out, the world underwent a swimming, twisting change. Lights came on, but of course they had been there all along. My family had moved into Maple Way Estates in June of 1959, the year before I was born. We still lived here, but the area had stopped being known as Maple Way Estates by 1963 or 64 at the latest. Out of the car, I was looking at my own house, on my own perfectly normal street. Just another part of Libertyville, PA. I looked back at Arnie, half expecting to see LeBay again, taxi driver from hell with his benighted cargo of the long dead. But it was only Arnie, wearing his high school jacket with his name sewn over the left breast. Arnie, looking too pale and too alone. Arnie, with a can of beer propped against his crotch.
Good night, man.
Good night, I said. Be careful going home. You don't want to get picked up.
I won't, he said. You take care, Dennis.
I will. I shut the door. My horror had changed to a deep and terrible sorrow. It was as if he had been buried. Buried alive. I watched Christine pull away from the curb and head off down the street. I watched until she turned the corner and disappeared from sight. Then I started up the walk to the house. The walk was clear. My dad had scattered most of a 10-pound bag of haylight over it, with me in mind. I was 3/4 of the way to the door when a grayness seemed to drift over me like smoke, and I had to stop and put my head down and try to hold on to myself. I could faint out here, I thought dimly, and then freeze to death on my own front walk, where once Arnie and I had played hopscotch and jacks and statue tag. At last, little by little, the grayness started to clear. I felt an arm around my waist. It was Dad, in his bathrobe and slippers.
Dennis, are you okay?
Was I okay? I had been driven home by a corpse.
Yeah, I said. Got a little dizzy. Let's get in. You'll freeze your butt off.
He walked up the steps with me, his arm still circling my waist. I was glad to have it.
Is Mom still up?
I asked.
No, she saw the New Year in, and then she and Ellie went to bed. Are you drunk, Dennis?
No.
You don't look good,
he said, slamming the door behind us. I uttered a crazy little shriek of laughter, and things went gray again, but only briefly this time. When I came back, he was looking at me with tight concern.
What happened over there?
Dad.
Dennis, you talk to me.
Dad.
I can't. What is it with him? What's wrong with him, Dennis?
I only shook my head, and it wasn't just the craziness of it, or fear for myself.
Now I was afraid for all of them. My dad, my mom, Elaine, Lee's folks. Coldly and sanely afraid. Just stay on my side, Dennis. You know what happens to shitters who don't.
Had I really heard that? Or had it been in my mind only? My father was still looking at me.
I can't. All right, he said. For now, I guess. But I need to know one thing, Dennis, and I want you to tell me. Do you have any reason to believe that Arnie was involved some way with Darnell's death and the deaths of those boys?
I thought of LeBay's rotting, grinning face, the flat pants poked up by something that could only have been bones.
No, I said, and that was almost the truth. Not Arnie.
All right, he said. You want to hand up the stairs?
I can make it okay. You go to bed yourself, Dad.
Yeah, I'm going to. Happy New Year, Dennis. And if you want to tell me, I'm still here.
Nothing to tell, I said.
Nothing I could tell. Somehow, he said. I doubt that.
I went up and got into bed and left the light on and didn't sleep at all. It was the longest night of my life, and several times I thought of getting up and going in with my mom and dad, the way I had done when I was small. Once I actually caught myself getting out of bed and groping for my crutches. I lay back down again. I was afraid for all of them. Yes, right. But that wasn't the worst. Not anymore. I was afraid of losing my mind. That was the worst. The sun was just poking over the horizon when I finally dropped off and dozed uneasily for 3 or 4 hours. And when I woke up, my mind had already begun trying to heal itself with unreality. My problem was that I could simply no longer afford to listen to that lulling song. The line was blurred for good.
Chapter 46. George LeBay Again. On Friday, the 5th of January, I got a postcard from Richard McCandless, secretary of the Libertyville American Legion Post. Written on the back in smudgy pencil was George LeBay's home address in Paradise Falls, Ohio. I carried the card around in my hip pocket most of the day, taking it out occasionally and looking at it. I didn't want to call him. I didn't want to talk to him about his crazy brother Roland again. I didn't want this crazy business to go any further at all. That evening, my father and mother went out to the Monroeville Mall with Ellie, who wanted to spend some of her Christmas money on a new pair of downhill skis. Half an hour after they were gone, I picked up the telephone and propped McCandless's postcard up in front of me. A call to the operator placed Paradise Falls in area code 513, Western Ohio. After a pause for thought, I called 513 Directory Assistance and got LeBay's number. I jotted it on the card, paused for thought again, a longer pause this time, and then picked up the phone a third time. I dialed half of LeBay's number and then hung up. Fuck it, I thought, full of nervous resentment I could not recall ever feeling before. Enough is enough, so fuck it. I'm not calling him. I'm done with it. I wash my hands of the whole crappy mess. Let him go to hell in his own handcar. Fuck it. Fuck it, I whispered, and got out of there before my conscience could begin to bore into me again. I went upstairs, took a sponge bath, and then turned in. I was soundly asleep before Ellie and my folks came back in, and I slept long and well that night. A good thing, because it was a long time before I slept that well again. A very long time. While I slept, something, killed Rudolph Junkins of the Pennsylvania State Police. It was in the paper when I got up next morning. "Darnell investigator murdered near Blairsville," the headline shouted. My father was upstairs taking a shower, Ellie and two of her friends out on the porch giggling and cawing over a game of Monopoly. My mother working on one of her stories in the sewing room. I was at the table by myself, stunned and scared. It occurred to me that Lee and her family were going to be back from California tomorrow. School would start again the day after, and unless Arnie, or LeBay, changed his mind, she would be actively pursued. I slowly pushed away the eggs I had scrambled for myself. I no longer wanted them. Last night it had seemed possible to push away the whole ominous and inexplicable business of Christine as easily as I'd just pushed away my breakfast. Now I wondered how I could have been so naive. Junkins was the man Arnie had mentioned New Year's Eve. I couldn't even kid myself that it hadn't been. The paper said he had been the man in charge of Pennsylvania's part of the Will Darnell investigation, and it hinted that some shadowy crime organization had been behind the murder. The Southern Mob, Arnie would have said, or the Crazy Colombians. I thought differently. Junkins's car had been driven off a lonely country road and battered to so much senseless wreckage.
That goddamn Junkins is still after me full steam ahead. He better watch out or somebody might just junk him. You stay on my side, Dennis. You know what happens to shitters who don't. With Junkins still inside it.
When Repperton and his friends were killed, Arnie had been in Philly with the chess club. When Darnell was killed, he was in Ligonier with his parents visiting relatives. Cast iron alibis. I thought he would have another for Junkins.
Seven. Seven deaths now, and they formed a deadly ring around Arnie Cunningham and Christine.
The police could surely see that. Not even a blind man could miss such an explicit chain of motivation. But the paper didn't say that anyone was aiding the police in their inquiries, as the British so delicately put it.
Of course, the police are not in the habit of just handing everything they know over to the newspapers. I knew that, but every instinct I had told me that the state cops weren't seriously investigating Arnie in connection with this latest murder by automobile. He was in the clear. What had Junkin seen behind him on that country road outside of Blairsville? A red and white car, I thought. Maybe empty. Maybe driven by a corpse. A goose ran squawking over my grave and my arms broke out in cold bumps. Seven people. Dead. It had to end. If for no other reason, then because maybe killing gets to be a habit. If Michael and Regina wouldn't go along with Arnie's crazy California plans, either of them or both of them might be next. Suppose he walked up to Lee in study hall period 3 next Tuesday and asked her to marry him, and Lee simply said no. What might she see idling at the curb when she got home that afternoon? Jesus Christ. I was scared. My mother poked in. Dennis, you're not eating. I looked up. I got reading the paper. Guess I'm not that hungry, Mom.
You have to eat, right, or you're not going to get well. Want me to make you oatmeal?
My stomach churned at the thought, but I smiled as I shook my head. No, but I'll eat a big lunch.
Promise?
Promise.
Danny, do you feel okay? You've looked so tired and peaked lately.
I'm fine, Mom. I widened my smile to show her how fine I was, and then I thought of her getting out of her blue Reliant at the Monroeville Mall, and two rows back was a white over red car, idling. In my mind's eye, I saw her walk in front of it, purse over her arm, saw Christine's transmission lever suddenly drop into drive.
Are you sure? It's not your leg bothering you, is it?
No.
Have you taken your vitamins?
Yes.
And your rose hips?
I burst out laughing.
She looked irritated for a moment, then smiled. You're a sassbox, Dennis Gilder, she said in her best Irish accent, which is pretty good since her mom came from the old sod.
And there's no kiver to you.
She went back to the sewing room, and in a moment, the irregular bursts of her typewriter began again. I picked up the newspaper and looked at the photo of Junkins's twisted auto. Death car, the caption beneath, read. Try this, I thought. Junkins is interested in a lot more than finding out who sold illegal fireworks and cigarettes to Will Darnell. Junkins is a state detective, and state detectives work on more than one case at a time. He could have been trying to find out who killed Moochie Welch, or he could have been... I crutched over to the sewing room and knocked.
Yes?
Sorry to bother you, Mom.
Don't be silly, Dennis. Are you going downtown today?
I might be. Why?
I'd like to go to the library.
By 3 o'clock that Saturday afternoon, it had begun to snow again. I had a slight headache from staring into the microfilm reader, but I had what I wanted. My hunch had been on the money. Not that it had been any great intuitive leap. Junkins had been in charge of the hit-and-run that had killed Moochie Welch, all right. And he had also been in charge of investigating what had happened to Repperton, Trelawney, and Bobby Stanton. He'd have to be one dumb cop not to read Arnie's name between the lines of what was happening. I leaned back in the chair, snapped off the reader, and closed my eyes. I tried to make myself be Junkins for a minute. He suspects Arnie of being involved with the murders. Not doing them, but involved somehow. Does he suspect Christine? Maybe he does. On the TV detective shows, they're always great at identifying guns, typewriters used to write ransom notes, and cars involved in hit-and-runs. Flakes and scrapes of paint, maybe. Then the Darnell bust looms up. For Junkins, that's nothing but great. The garage will be closed, and everything in it impounded. Maybe Junkins suspects... What? I worked harder at imagining. I'm a cop. I believe in legitimate answers, sane answers, routine answers. So what do I suspect? After a moment, it came. An accomplice, of course. I suspect an accomplice. It has to be an accomplice. Nobody in his right mind would suspect that the car was doing it herself, so... So after the garage is closed, Junkins brings in the best technicians and lab men he can lay his hands on. They go over Christine from stem to stern, looking for evidence of what has happened, reasoning as Junkins would reason, trying to anyway. I think that there has to be some evidence. Hitting a human body is not like hitting a feather pillow. Hitting the crash barrier out at Squantic Hills is not like hitting a feather pillow either. So what do they find, these experts in vehicular homicide? Nothing. They find no dents, no touch-up repainting, no bloodstains. They find no embedded brown paint flakes from the Squantic Hills road barrier that was broken off. In short, Junkins finds absolutely no evidence that Christine was used in either crime. Now jump ahead to Darnell's murder. Does Junkins hustle over to the garage the next day to check on Christine? I would if it was me. The sight of a house isn't a feather pillow either, and a car that has just crashed through one must have sustained major damage, damage that simply couldn't have been repaired overnight. And when he gets there, what does he find? Only Christine, without so much as a ding in her fender. That led to another deduction, one that explained why Junkins had never put a stakeout on the car. I hadn't been able to understand that because he must have suspected that Christine was involved, but in the end, logic had ruled him. And perhaps it had killed him as well. Junkins hadn't put a stake out on her because Christine's alibi, while mute, was every bit as ironclad as those of her owner. If he had inspected Christine immediately following the murder of Will Darnell, Junkins must have concluded that the car could not have been involved, no matter how persuasive the evidence to the contrary seemed. Not a scratch on her. And why not? It was just that Junkins hadn't had all the facts. I thought about the odometer that ran backward, and Arnie saying, just a glitch. I thought of the nest of cracks in the windshield that had seemed to grow smaller and draw inward, as if they were running backward, too. I thought of the haphazard replacement of parts that seemed totally without rhyme or reason. Last of all, I thought of my nightmare ride home on Sunday night. Old cars that looked new clumped up at the curb outside houses where parties were going on. The Strand Theater intact again in all of its yellow brick solidity. The half-built development that had been completed and occupied by Libertyville suburbanites 20 years ago. Just a glitch. I thought that not knowing about that glitch was what had really killed Rudolph Junkins. Because, look, if you own a car long enough, things wear out, no matter how well you take care of it. And they usually go randomly. A car comes off the assembly line like a newborn baby, and just like a newborn, it starts rolling down an Indian gauntlet of years. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune crack a battery here, bust a tie rod there, freeze a bearing somewhere else. The carburetor float sticks, a tire blows, there's an electrical short, the upholstery starts getting ratty. It's like a movie, and if you could run the film backward. "Will there be anything else, sir?" the records clerk asked from behind me, and I nearly screamed. Mom was waiting for me in the main lobby, and she chatted most of the way home about her writing and her new class, which was disco dancing. I nodded and replied in most of the right places, and I thought that if Junkins had brought in his technicians, his high-powered auto specialist from Harrisburg, they had probably overlooked an elephant while looking for a needle. I couldn't blame them either. Cars just don't run backward, like a movie in reverse. And there are no such things as ghosts or revenants or demons preserved in Quaker State motor oil. Believe in one? Believe in all, I thought, and shuddered. "Want to turn up the heater, Denny?" Mom asked brightly. "Would you, Mom?" I thought of Lee, who was due back tomorrow. Lee, with her lovely face, enhanced by those slanting, almost cruel cheekbones, her young and sweetly luscious figure that had not yet been marred by the forces of time or gravity. Like that long-ago Plymouth that had rolled out of Detroit on a carrier in 1957, she was, in a sense, still under warranty. Then I thought of LeBay, who was dead and yet undead, and I thought of his lust. But was it lust or just a need to spoil things? I thought of Arnie saying with calm assurance that they were going to be married. And then, with a helpless clarity, I saw their wedding night. I saw her looking up into the darkness of some motel room and seeing a rotting, grinning corpse poised over her. I heard her screams as Christine, a Christine still festooned with crepe streamers and soaped-on just-married signs, waited faithfully outside the closed and locked door. Christine, or the terrible female force that animated her, would know Lee wouldn't last long, and she, Christine, would be around when Lee was gone. I closed my eyes to block the images out, but that only intensified them. It had begun with Lee wanting Arnie, and had progressed logically enough to Arnie wanting her back. But it hadn't stopped there, had it? Because now LeBay had Arnie, and he wanted Lee. But he wasn't going to have her, not if I could help it. That night, I called George LeBay. "Yes, Mr. Gilder," he said. He sounded older, tireder. "I remember you very well. I talked your ear off in front of my unit in what I believe may have been the most depressing motel in the universe. What can I do for you?" He sounded as though he hoped I wouldn't require too much. I hesitated. Did I tell him that his brother had come back from the dead, that not even the grave had been able to end his hate of the shitters? Did I tell him he had possessed my friend, had picked him out as unerringly as Arnie had picked out Christine? Did we talk about mortality and time and rancid love? "Mr. Gilder, are you there?" "I've got a problem, Mr. LeBay, and I don't know exactly how to tell you about it. It concerns your brother." Something new came into his voice then, something tight and controlled. "I don't know what sort of a problem you could have that would concern him. Raleigh's dead." "That's just it." Now I was unable to control my own voice. It trembled up to a higher octave and then drifted back down again. "I don't think he is." "What are you talking about?" His voice was taut, accusing and fearful. "If this is your idea of a joke, I assure you it's in the poorest possible taste. No joke. Just let me tell you some of the stuff that's happened since your brother died. Mr. Gilder, I have several sets of papers to correct, and a novel I want to finish, and I really don't have time to indulge in—" "Please," I said. "Please, Mr. LeBay, please help me. And help my friend." There was a long, long pause, and then LeBay sighed. "Tell your tale," he said. And then, after a brief pause, he added, "God damn you." I passed the story along to him by way of modern long-distance cable. I can imagine my voice going through computerized switching stations full of miniaturized circuits under snow-blanketed wheat fields and finally into the ear of this man. I told him about Arnie's trouble with Repperton, Buddy's expulsion and revenge. I told him about the death of Moochie Welch, what had happened at Squantic Hills, what had happened during the Christmas Eve storm. I told him about windshield cracks that seemed to run backward and an odometer that did for sure. I told him about the radio that seemed to receive only WDIL, the oldies station, no matter where you set it. That brought a soft grunt of surprise from George LeBay. I told him about the handwriting on my casts, and how the one Arnie had done on Thanksgiving night matched his brother's signature on Christine's original registration form. I told him about Arnie's constant use of the word shitters, the way he had started combing his hair like Fabian, or one of those other 50s greaseballs. I told him everything, in fact, except what had happened to me on my ride home early on New Year's morning. I had intended to, but I simply could not do it. I never let that out of myself until I wrote all of this down 4 years later. When I finished, there was a silence on the line. "Mr. LeBay, are you still there?" "I'm here," he said finally. "Mr. Gilder, Dennis, I don't intend to offend you, but you must realize that what you are suggesting goes far beyond any possible psychic phenomena and extends into..." He trailed off. "Madness?" "That isn't the word I would have used. From what you say, you were involved in a terrible football accident. You were in the hospital for 2 months and in great pain for some of that time. Now, isn't it possible that your imagination...
Mr. LeBay, I said, did your brother ever have a saying about the little tramp?
What?
The little tramp. Like when you throw a ball of paper at the wastebasket and hit it, you say 2 points? Only instead of that, watch me put it up the little tramp's ass. Did your brother ever say that?
How did you know that?
And then, without giving me time to answer, he used the phrase on one of the occasions when you met him, didn't he?
No.
Mr. Gilder, you're a liar.
I said nothing. I was shaking, weak-kneed. No adult had ever said that to me in my whole life.
Dennis, I'm sorry. But my brother is dead. He was an unpleasant, possibly even an evil human being, but he is dead, and all of these morbid fancies and fantasies... Who was the little tramp? I managed.
Silence.
Was it Charlie Chaplin?
I didn't think he was going to reply at all. Then, at last, heavily, he said,
Only at second hand.
He meant Hitler. There was a passing resemblance between Hitler and Chaplin's little tramp. Chaplin made a movie called The Great Dictator. You've probably never even seen it. It was a common enough name for him during the war years, at any rate. He would be much too young to remember. But it means nothing.
It was my turn to remain silent.
It means nothing, he shouted. Nothing! It's vapors and suggestions, nothing more! You must see this!
There's 7 people dead over here in western Pennsylvania, I said. That's not just vapors.
There are the signatures on my casts. They're not vapors either. I saved them, Mr. LeBay. Let me send them to you. Look at them and tell me if one of them isn't your brother's handwriting.
It could be a knowing or unknowing forgery.
If you believe that, get a handwriting expert. I'll pay for it.
You could do that yourself.
Mr. LeBay, I said, I don't need any more convincing.
But what do you want from me? To share your fantasy? I won't do that. My brother is dead. His car is just a car.
He was lying. I felt it. Even through the telephone, I felt it.
I want you to explain something you said to me that night we talked. What would that be?
He sounded wary. I licked my lips.
You said he was obsessed and angry, but he wasn't a monster. At least you said you didn't think he was. Then it seemed like you changed the subject completely. But the more I think about it, the more I think you didn't change the subject at all. The next thing you said was that he never put a mark on either of them.
Dennis, really,
Look, if you were going to say something, for Christ's sake, say it now, I cried. My voice cracked. I wiped my forehead, and my hand came away slimy with sweat. This is no easier for me than it is for you. Arnie's fixated on this girl. Her name is Lee Cabot, only I don't think it's Arnie who's fixated on her at all. I think it's your brother, your dead brother. Now talk to me, please.
He sighed.
Talk to you, he said. Talk to you. To talk about these old events. No, these old suspicions. That would be almost the same as to shake a sleeping fiend, Dennis. Please, I know nothing.
I could have told him the fiend was already awake, but he knew that.
Tell me what you suspect.
I'll call you back.
Mr. LeBay, please,
I'll call you back, he said. I've got to call my sister, Marcia, in Colorado.
If it will help, I'll call...
No. She would never talk to you. We've only talked of it to each other once or twice, if that... I hope your conscience is clear on this matter, Dennis. Because you are asking us to rip open old scars and make them bleed again. So I'll ask you once more. How sure are you?
Sure,
I whispered. I'll call you back, he said, and hung up. 15 minutes went past, then 20. I went around the room on my crutches, unable to sit still. I looked out the window at the wintry street, a study in blacks and whites. Twice I went to the telephone and didn't pick it up, afraid he would be trying to get me at the same time, even more afraid that he wouldn't call back at all. The third time, just as I put my hand on it, it rang. I jerked back as if stung, and then scooped it up.
Hi?
Ellie's breathless voice said from downstairs. Donna?
Is Dennis Gilder?
LeBay's voice began, sounding older and more broken than ever.
I've got it, Ellie,
I said.
Well, who cares?
Ellie said pertly, and hung up. Hello, Mr. LeBay, I said. My heart was thudding hard.
I spoke to her, he said heavily. She tells me only to use my own judgment. But she is frightened. Together, you and I have conspired to frighten an old lady who has never hurt anyone and has nothing whatever to do with this.
In a good cause, I said.
Is it?
If I didn't think so, I wouldn't have called you, I said.
Are you going to talk to me or not, Mr. LeBay?
Yes, he said. To you, but to no one else. If you should tell someone else, I would deny it, you understand?
Yes.
Very well, he sighed. In our conversation last summer, Dennis, I told you one lie about what happened, and one lie about what Marcy and I felt about it. We lied to ourselves. If it hadn't been for you, I think we could have continued to lie to ourselves about that incident by the highway for the rest of our lives.
The little girl? LeBay's daughter?
I was holding the phone tightly, squeezing it. Yes, he said heavily. Rita.
What really happened when she choked?
My mother used to call Raleigh her changeling, LeBay said. Did I tell you that?
No.
No, of course not. I told you I thought your friend would be happier if he got rid of the car, but there was only so much a person can say in defense of one's beliefs, because the irrational, it creeps in.
He paused. I didn't prompt him. He would tell or he wouldn't. It was as simple as that.
My mother said he was a perfectly good baby until he was 6 months old. And then she said that was when Puck came. She said Puck took her good baby for one of his jokes and replaced him with a changeling. She laughed when she said it, but she never said it when Raleigh was around to hear, and her eyes never laughed, Dennis. I think it was her only explanation for what he was, for why he was so untouchable in his rage, so single-minded in his few simple purposes. There was a boy, I have forgotten his name, a bigger boy who thrashed Raleigh 3 or 4 times, a bully. He would start on Raleigh's clothes and ask him if he'd worn his underpants 1 month or 2 this time, and Raleigh would fight him and curse him and threaten him, and the bully would laugh at him and hold him off with his longer arms and punch him until he was tired or until Raleigh's nose was bleeding. And then Raleigh would sit there on the corner, smoking a cigarette and crying with blood and snot drying on his face. And if Drew or I came near him, he would beat us to within an inch of our lives. That bully's house burned down one night, Dennis. The bully and the bully's father and the bully's little brother were killed. The bully's sister was horribly burned. It was supposed to have been the stove in the kitchen, and maybe it was. But the fire sirens woke me up, and I was still awake when Raleigh came up the ivy trellis and into the room I shared with him. There was soot on his forehead, and he smelled of gasoline. He saw me lying there with my eyes open, and he said, "If you tell Georgie, I'll kill you." And ever since that night, Dennis, I've tried to tell myself that he meant if I told he had been out watching the fire. And maybe that was all it was. My mouth was dry. There seemed to be a lead ball in my stomach. The hairs along the nape of my neck felt like dry quills.
How old was your brother then?
I asked hoarsely. Not quite 13. LeBay said, with terrible false calm. One winter day, about a year later, there was a fight during a hockey game, and a fellow named Randy Throgmorton laid open Raleigh's head with his stick, knocked him senseless. We got him to old Dr. Farner. Raleigh had come around by then, but he was still groggy, and Farner put 12 stitches in his scalp. A week later, Randy Throgmorton fell through the ice on Palmer Pond and was drowned. He had been skating in an area clearly marked with thin ice signs. apparently.
Are you saying your brother killed these people? Are you leading up to telling me that LeBay killed his own daughter?
Not that he killed her, Dennis. Never think that. She choked to death. What I am suggesting is that he may have let her die.
You said he turned her over, punched her, tried to make her vomit.
That's what Raleigh told me at the funeral, George said.
Then what?
Marcia and I talked it over later. Only that once, you understand. Over dinner that night. Raleigh told me, I picked her up by her Buster Browns and tried to whack that son of a bitch out of there, Georgie, but it was stuck down fast. And what Veronica told Marcia was, Raleigh picked her up by her shoes and tried to whack whatever was choking her out of there, but it was stuck down fast. They told exactly the same story, in exactly the same words. And you know what that made me think of?
No.
It made me think of Raleigh climbing in the bedroom window and whispering to me, if you tell Georgie, I'll kill you.
But why? Why would he...
Later, Veronica wrote Marcia a letter and hinted that Raleigh had made no real effort to save their daughter, and that, at the very end, he put her back in the car. So she would be out of the sun, he said, but in her letter, Veronica said she thought Raleigh wanted her to die in the car.
I didn't want to say it, but I had to. Are you suggesting that your brother offered his daughter up as some kind of a human sacrifice?
There was a long, thinking, dreadful pause. Not in any conscious way, no, LeBay said. Not any more than I am suggesting that he consciously murdered her. If you had known my brother, you would know how ridiculous it is to suspect him of witchcraft or sorcery or trafficking with demons. He believed in nothing beyond his own senses, except, I suppose, for his own will. I'm suggesting that he might have had some intuition, or that he might have been directed to do what he did. My mother said he was a changeling.
And Veronica?
I don't know, he said. The police verdict was suicide, even though there was no note. It may well have been, but the poor woman had made some friends in town, and I have often wondered if perhaps she had hinted to some of them, as she had to Marcia, that Rita's death was not quite as she and Raleigh had reported it. I have wondered if Raleigh found out. If you tell Georgie, I'll kill you. There's no proof one way or the other, of course. But I've wondered why she would do it the way she did. And I've wondered how a woman who didn't know the slightest thing about cars would know enough to get the hose and attach it to the exhaust pipe and put it in through the window. I try not to wonder about those things. They keep me awake at night. I thought about what he had said, and about the things he hadn't said, the things he had left between the lines. Intuitive, he had said, so single-minded in his few simple purposes, he had said. Suppose Roland LeBay had understood in some way he wouldn't even admit to himself that he was investing his Plymouth with some supernatural power. And suppose he had only been waiting for the right inheritor to come along. And now, does that answer your questions, Dennis?
I think it does,
I said slowly. What are you going to do?
I think you know that.
Destroy the car.
I'm going to try, I said,
and then looked over at my crutches, leaning against the wall. My goddamn crutches. You may destroy your friend as well.
I may save him, I said.
Quietly, George LeBay said, I wonder if that is still possible. Chapter 47 The Betrayal.
I kissed her. Her arms slipped around my neck. One of her cool hands pressed lightly against the back of my head. There was no more question for me about what was going on, and when she pulled slightly away from me, her eyes half closed, I could see there was no question for her, either. "Dennis," she murmured, and I kissed her again. Our tongues touched, gently. For a moment, her kiss intensified. I could feel the passion those high cheekbones hinted at. Then she gasped a little and drew back. "That's enough," she said. "We'll be arrested for indecent exposure or something." It was January 18th. We were parked in the lot behind the local Kentucky Fried, the remains of a pretty decent chicken dinner spread around us. We were in my duster, and that alone was something of an occasion for me. It was my first time behind the wheel since the accident. Just that morning, the doctor had removed the huge cast on my left leg and replaced it with a brace. His warning to stay off it was stern, but I could tell he was feeling good about the way things were going for me. My recovery was about a month ahead of schedule. He put it down to superior technique, my mother to positive thinking in chicken soup, Coach Puffer to rose hips. Me? I thought Lee Cabot had a lot to do with it. "We have to talk," she said. "No, let's make out some more," I said. "Talk now, make out later." "Has he started again?" She nodded. In the almost 2 weeks since my telephone conversation with LeBay, the first 2 weeks of winter term, Arnie had been working at making a rapprochement with Lee, working at it with an intensity that scared both of us. I had told her about my talk with George LeBay, but not, as I've said, about my terrible ride home on New Year's morning, and made it as clear as I could that on no account should she simply cut him off. That would drive him into a fury, and these days when Arnie was furious with someone, unpleasant things happened to them. "That makes it like cheating on him," she said. "I know," I said, more sharply than I had intended. "I don't like it, but I don't want that car rolling again."
"So?"
And I shook my head. In truth, I was starting to feel like Prince Hamlet, delaying and delaying. I knew what had to be done, of course. Christine had to be destroyed. Lee and I had looked into ways of doing it. The first idea had been Lee's, Molotov cocktails. We would, she said, fill some wine bottles with gasoline, take them to the Cunningham house in the early morning hours, light the wicks. "Wicks? What wicks?" I asked. "Kotex ought to do just fine," she answered promptly, causing me to wonder again about her high-cheekboned forebearers. "And toss them in through Christine's windows." "What if the windows are rolled up and the doors are locked?" I asked her. "That's the way it's apt to be, you know." She looked at me as if I was a total drip. "Are you saying," she asked, "that the idea of firebombing Arnie's car is okay, but you've got moral scruples about breaking some glass?" "No," I said, "but who's going to get close enough to her to break the glass with a hammer, Lee, you?" She looked at me, biting at her soft lower lip. She said nothing. The next idea had been mine. Dynamite. Lee thought about it and shook her head. "I could get it without too much sweat, I think," I said. "I still saw Brad Jeffries from time to time, and Brad still worked for Penn DOT, and Penn DOT had enough dynamite to put Three River Stadium on the moon. I thought that maybe I could borrow the right key without Brad knowing I had borrowed it. He had a way of getting tanked up when the Penguins were on the tube. Borrow the key to the explosive shed during the third period of one game, I thought, and return it to his ring in the third period of another. The chance that he would be wanting explosives in January and thus realize his key was missing was small indeed. It was a deception, another betrayal, but it was a way to end things."
"No,"
she said. "Why not? To me, dynamite seemed to offer the kind of utter finality the situation demanded."
"Because Arnie keeps it parked in his driveway now. Do you really want to send shrapnel flying all over a suburban neighborhood? Risking a piece of flying glass cutting off some little kid's head?"
I winced. I hadn't thought of that. But now that she mentioned it, the image seemed sharp and clear and hideous. And that got me thinking about other things. Lighting a bundle of dynamite with your cigarillo and then tossing it overhand at the object you wanted to destroy, that might look okay on the Saturday afternoon westerns they showed on Channel 2. but in real life there were blasting caps and contact points to deal with. Still, I held on to the idea as long as I could. If we did it at night? Still pretty dangerous, she said. And you know it, too. It's all over your face. A long, long pause. What about the crusher at Darnell's? She asked finally. Same basic objection as before, I said. Who gets to drive her down there? You, me, or Arnie? And that was where matters still stood. What was it today? I asked her.
He wanted me to go out with him tonight, she said. Bowling this time.
In previous days it had been the movies, out for dinner, over to watch TV at his house, proposed study dates. Christine figured in all of them as the mode of transport.
He's getting ugly about it, and I'm running out of excuses. If we're going to do something, we ought to do it soon.
I nodded. Failure to find a satisfactory method was one thing. The other thing holding us back had been my leg. Now, the cast was off, and although I was on stern doctor's orders to use my crutches, I had tested the left leg without them. There was some pain, but not as much as I had feared. Those things, yeah, but mostly, there had been us, discovering each other, and although it's going to sound stinking, I guess I ought to add something else if this is going to stay straight. And I promised myself when I began to tell the tale that I'd stop if I found I couldn't get it straight or keep it straight. The spice of danger had added something to what I felt for her, and I think to what she felt for me. He was my best friend, but there was still a dirty, senseless attraction in the idea that we were seeing each other behind his back. I felt that each time I drew her into my arms, each time my hand slipped over the firm swelling of her breasts, the sneaking around. Can you tell me why that should have an attraction? But it did. For the first time in my life, I had fallen for a girl. I had slipped before, but this time I had taken the grand head-over-heels tumble. And I loved it. I loved her. That constant sense of betrayal, though, that was a snake-like thing. Both a shame and a crazy sort of goad. We could tell each other, and we did, that we were keeping our mouths shut to protect our families and ourselves. That was true. But it wasn't all, Lee, was it? No. It wasn't all. In one way, nothing worse could have happened. Love slows down reaction time. It mutes the sense of danger. My conversation with George LeBay was 12 long days in the past, and thinking about the things he had said, and worse, the things he had suggested, no longer raised the hair on the back of my neck. The same was true, or not true, of the few times I talked with Arnie, or glimpsed him in the halls. In a strange way, we seemed to be back in September and October again, when we had grown apart simply because Arnie was so busy. When we did talk, he seemed pleasant enough, although the gray eyes behind his specs were cool. I waited for a wailing Regina or a distraught Michael to call me on the phone with the news that Arnie had finally stopped toying with them and had given up the idea of college in the fall for certain. That didn't happen. And it was from Motormouth himself, our guidance counselor, that I heard Arnie had taken home a lot of literature on the University of Pennsylvania, Drew University, and Penn State. Those were the schools Lee was most interested in. I knew it, and Arnie knew it, too. Two nights earlier, I had happened to overhear my mother and my sister Ellie in the kitchen. "Why doesn't Arnie ever come over anymore, Mom?" Ellie asked. "Did he and Dennis have a fight?"
"No, honey," my mother answered. "I don't think so. But when friends get older, sometimes they grow apart."
"That's never going to happen to me," Ellie said, with all the awesome conviction of the just-turned 15. I sat in the other room, wondering if maybe that was really all it was. Hallucination brought on by my long stay in the hospital, as LeBay had suggested, and a simple growing apart, a developing space between two childhood friends. I could see a certain logic to it, even down to my fixation on Christine, the wedge that had come between us. It ignored the hard facts, but it was comfortable. To believe such a thing would allow Lee and me to pursue our ordinary lives, to get involved in school activities,
to do a little extra cramming for the Scholastic Achievement Tests in March,